However routine the illness may seem, when tens or even hundreds of people become sick in one location in a short span of time, it gets your attention. The norovirus spreads fast and makes people very sick, albeit relatively briefly. There was a recent outbreak in Syracuse affecting 95 people who'd eaten at a local restaurant. So we thought that we would take a look into the matter of the norovirus today on Please Explain. And joining us now are Dr. Aaron Margolin, a professor with the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Biomedical Sciences at the University of New Hampshire, and Dr. Christine Moe, the Eugene J. Gangarosa Professor of Safe Water and Sanitation and the Director of the Center of Global Water at Emory University. Her laboratory research program focuses on neuroviruses, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. And we also invite our listeners to call in. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. Dr. Margolin, what does noro mean?
It is actually the name that was given when the virus was first discovered back in 1968 in Norwalk, Ohio. It's actually part of a group of larger viruses, or a larger group of viruses called the Calici viruses, which mean cup shape, and that's kind of what they look like when you see them under the electron microscope.
So this is what is also called the Norwalk virus?
Yes, it started out originally, way back when, as an unidentified virus, and it was considered a small virus. It was had presented some structured, so they put it into a group known as small structured round viruses. And as time went along and as technology increased, we were able to learn more about it, and then we were able to determine through different means that in 1968 this was a responsible for an outbreak of gastroenteritis in a school, and it was in Norwalk, Ohio, and so they named this the Norwalk virus. That continued the naming of the virus based upon where the outbreak occurred for many years to follow. So
a rotavirus broke out in a Rotary Club?
No. That's a whole different virus. When viruses are broken down into different groupings based upon either their nucleic acid, their structure, things of this nature. So rotavirus actually is named more because when you look at it under the electron microscope, it looks like a wheel, and that's what rota means, is a wheel. But noro is different, but you'll find things like Snow Mountain Agent, and that was named after an outbreak that occurred in a ski lodge out in Colorado. And but as time went along, we were able to determine where these viruses were all grouped together, and Norwalk virus then became part of a larger group known as the noroviruses.
Dr. Moe, isn't it an RNA virus, a single strand of RNA? What is that? How does that work?
Oh, good question. Well, RNA viruses in general can be RNA or DNA. That's the genetic material that they have. And as you said, the noroviruses are single-stranded RNA viruses. And I think maybe the important part of that in terms of how they affect people is that they can mutate more rapidly than some other organisms. The RNA, in the RNA replication, it's not very accurate, so there can be mistakes and random mutations, and that can lead to a lot of different strains of viruses. So as Dr. Margolin said, these are actually quite a large family of viruses.
But if they're RNA strands, then they're not alive in the way that bacteria are alive, are they?
Well, maybe not in the same way as bacteria, but I guess I would argue that they're very much alive. Alive and sneaky, I would say.
Are they the causes of what we also call stomach flus and food poisoning?
Definitely stomach flu is a common way to refer to the viral gastroenteritis that Dr. Margolin mentioned. Sometimes people may say food poisoning, although technically food poisoning is due to a toxin in the food that's formed by bacteria. So we don't really think of viruses or the noroviruses as causing food poisoning.
And are these found everywhere in the world?
Yes, they are. Everywhere that people have looked for them, they have been found.
So, Dr. Margolin, what does the norovirus do when it infects a normal cell?
Well, most of the time, this is enters into the body in what we call the fecal-oral route, and this is a situation of where, whether we'd like to admit it or not, we are going to be consuming a product, whether it be food or water, that has some sort of fecal contamination. In the case of the noroviruses, that also applies for vomitus, and when we vomit, the little small droplets of our vomit don't always go where we know where they're going to go. And at any one time, either food or your own hands or any kind of object can bring this and enter it into your mouth. And once it gets into your mouth and then it gets into your digestive tract, there are a set of cells that are lining everyone's intestines, and these viruses have the ability to enter into the cells. And one of the things viruses do in their normal replication is that they break open the cell as a means of releasing new viruses to infect new cells. And you can imagine that as your cells begin to die and break open, this acts as a major irritant, and as an irritant, your intestinal tract starts moving quicker. And in this case, it moves quicker in both directions, and the result being that you end up throwing up or vomit, and or you have material going down the large intestines and the water is not reabsorbed back into the body, and that's classically known as diarrhea. And in this case, they go in both directions, so that's why oftentimes you hear people saying that they've been purging themselves out of both ends of their body. And I think if you look at the body as being one long pipe with a hollow middle, that's a very accurate description of what happens.
Dr. Mo, there are all sorts of different things that make us sick intestinally. I mentioned rotaviruses earlier. There's E. coli, there's salmonella, there's listeria. Do they have anything in common, or are they all the only thing they have in common that they attack our gastrointestinal tract?
I think that that's a good explanation. The main thing they have in common is that they focus on the gastrointestinal tract, but different organisms, different enteric organisms use different mechanisms. So some of them have toxins, some of them, the viruses actually replicate in the cell, the bacteria cause damage from other, using other strategies. So the only thing they really have in common is that they focus on the gastrointestinal tract.
Now, Dr. Margolin, you said that it's transmitted either through fecal material. That's the usual way. How does that work? I mean, when 95 people get sick in a restaurant in Syracuse, I can't imagine that fecal material played any role in that.
That most people realize that, but it unfortunately, on a very regular basis, knowingly and not knowingly, we are constantly exposed to the consumption of fecally contaminated material. And you can think about that in many different ways. For example, if you go swimming in a public pool, and you know most people will jump into a pool and open their mouth and take a mouthful of water, and you have to realize that that water has been involved with all the other body parts from all the other people that are there. So that's in a very obvious way that one is contaminating themselves with the fecal oral route. The other way is many of us have all been to bathrooms where we've seen the signs on the bathroom walls that state, you know, to all employees, you must wash your hands after you get done using the bathroom. Many employees don't wash their hands, and many employees don't actually know the correct procedure for washing their hands. And in addition, the use of hand sanitizers has also been demonstrated as another means of helping to spread this fecal-oral route. And it's not just
a sanitizer does that?
Yeah, well, hand sanitizers have replaced the old-fashioned method of cleaning our hands, which was to stand over a sink and use soap and water and do that for about 30 seconds. Or, as I tell my class, you sing the happy birthday song slowly twice, and you've, you know, done a good job of cleaning your hands. Nowadays, we have replaced that with what are mostly alcohol-based hand sanitizers, and people think by doing that, they are now rendering their hands free of all infectious organisms, when we know that there's a reduction, but especially things like norovirus are not necessarily affected or affected very well. So we have feces that can be transmitted that way, and don't forget, norovirus is also found in the vomitus of individuals, and so when you have somebody vomiting, little droplets of vomit can get all around, and then you take your hands and you touch, like a desktop, for example. I'm in a school situation, so somebody could have thrown up or coughed or whatever, and then they touch their desk and they take their hands and they put it in their mouth or they put their pen in their mouth, and everything's always going towards the mouth or the face. And so there's many mechanisms that allow a constant reinfection of these organisms to the gastrointestinal tract.
Well, Dr. Mo, with that in mind, how long do these viruses survive outside of a body? If I throw up on my desk and then we wipe it up, does somebody come in an hour later and get sick because they touched that desk?
So we have actually done some studies on how long the viruses can persist outside the body. And we've looked at how long the viruses can persist in water, on hands, and also on surfaces. And it's a little bit tricky to study these viruses because we can't grow them outside the body. So we have to use molecular techniques to detect the RNA. And so when we detect the RNA, we can't guarantee that there's still a live infectious virus. But if we don't detect the RNA, we know that there isn't a live infectious virus. So when we've done these studies on surfaces, we've been able to detect the RNA from these viruses for 4 to 6 weeks on surfaces like Formica. When we have tested how long the virus can survive in water, we sampled, we put some water, virus in water in my lab, groundwater that we had collected that we tested to make sure it was safe. We kept it in the dark at room temperature for 60 days, actually beyond 60 days, and we could detect the viral RNA in the water for up to a year, actually. But for at different time points, we gave aliquots of that water to human volunteers to drink to see if the virus was also infectious, that it wasn't just the RNA surviving in the water. And we found that even after 60 days, people who drank that water got infected with Norwalk virus. So we think that this virus is extremely persistent. On hands, we only tested up to 2 hours because you can't really ask someone to sit around with a virus on their hands for more than 2 hours. But we found that the virus was easily persistent on hands for 2 hours.
My guests are Dr. Christine Mo, the Eugene J. Gangarosa Professor of Safe Water and Sanitation and the Director of the Center for Global Water at Emory University, and Dr. Aaron Margolin, a professor with the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Biomedical Sciences at the University of New Hampshire. We are talking about noroviruses on today's Please Explain. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener has asked about this, this is a listener from Brooklyn Heights. This just blew through my whole family. When are we contagious? Before we get sick, during, after, or the whole time? And how long do we remain contagious? Which one of you wants to take that? You go ahead, and I'm sure Dr. Mo will have things to add.
The answer is yes to all of the above. It really depends upon the person and the genotype of the virus itself. There are several different genotypes of norovirus, but you can be sick in what's known as the prodromal state. This is the state that occurs before actual symptomology is happening, and you're shedding the virus from your body. You obviously can be shedding the virus from your body while you are sick, and then there is what's known as the convalescent phase, when you the symptoms of the illness have actually stopped, but you are still shedding the virus, and actually that is in many cases one of the worst times, because you think that you're okay, yet and you may start cutting corners on your sanitary practices like hand washing and actually be actually spreading the virus, because you are still shedding it from your feces and furthering it on to other individuals. And the listener was very correct in saying blowing through, because usually that's exactly how it happens, is that individuals within a family do share their fecal material. One of the best and easiest ways, for example, Dr. Gerber from the University of Arizona had shown this long time ago, is what is called a toilet sneeze, and that is those individuals who store their toothbrushes next to the toilet. When someone flushes the toilet, there's a aerosolization of water that goes beyond 6 feet and has a very nice way of coating all of the surrounding area with the fecal flora found in that individual's intestines.
Wait a minute. I would say that 98% of all of the bathrooms I've seen in apartments, maybe in private homes as well, the toilet is next to the sink that people brush their teeth in.
And that is why when the listener said it blew through their family, they were correct, because as they flushed the toilet after defecating in it, they created what is called a toilet sneeze. Dr. Gerber, you can go online. He actually has what's called a toilet chromatograph, where he shows the distribution pattern of what happens when you flush a toilet. And depending upon the forcefulness of the water, it can travel upwards of 6 to 8 feet away, contaminating the entire area, including the surfaces of the other sinks, including toothbrushes, including anything else that you might end up putting in your mouth.
This is scary. It's amazing we don't have more people getting sick. But I want to get back to part of that question that listener wrote in about. You get what you think is whatever we're going to call it. We think of it as a stomach flu or stomach virus. And it lasts 2 days maximum. But are we saying here that it actually remains in the body a lot longer? Why does it seem to be so brief?
I'll let Dr. Mo take that one.
Sure. So we have done studies where we have had human volunteers. We do these studies in the hospital, and we deliberately give them doses of virus and study the course of the infection. And the symptoms typically last 48 hours, maybe 72 hours. In most people, the symptoms are relatively mild, but that's not true across the board. But your body's immune system usually kicks in, and it's called a self-limited illness. So for most people, 48 to 72 hours. But I think what your listener asked about how long are you infectious, in our studies with human volunteers, most people were still excreting the virus in their feces even for 7 to 10 days after they had first been exposed to the virus.
Now, go ahead.
We had a few people, very few, but a few people who were still shedding the virus after 35 days.
Wow.
So a month after they had first become infected. And you can imagine that has important implications for food handlers. So if you have somebody who's working in a restaurant who gets sick for a couple days and then they stay home and they come back to work, but they could still be shedding the virus, they may be contagious and not realize it.
Dr. Margolin, can we develop immunities to it if we have had a norovirus attack last year? Does that mean that our bodies are prepared for another one now?
And that's kind of an interesting question, because this virus is very unique in that aspect, in twofold. One, the immunity that is elicited in your body when you become infected with this virus is very short-lived, and which means that you can become infected again relatively soon after, I say relative, within a year easily, if not even sooner, after you recover from an infection. In addition to that, there are multiple types of this, and the immunity that you may develop against one type does not transfer against another type. So I can go ahead and you can become infected with one type, have an immunity, and a couple days later be exposed to another type, and once again get infected again. And in fact, in the early studies of this virus, the actual detection of antibodies from this virus were used as a way of determining whether you were actually susceptible for infection, because these antibodies were not protecting antibodies, but demonstrated that, you know, you can become infected over a period of time, many times over.
Joe in New Jersey has written in to ask, why can some animals consume fecal matter without getting sick? Do humans just have weak guts, he writes?
No, I don't think that.
Are neuroviruses, do they just attack humans?
No, there is two groups that also attack bovine and cattle. So there's more. I mean, I don't think that humans have a weak intestinal system. I think that, in fact, if you look at the number of times we actually end up consuming fecal material and then compare that to the actual times we get sick or we become infectious, I think you're going to find out that we have quite a good immune system. And let's face it, that's what's kept us alive all these years. I think, you know, it's a very strong immune system.
Does fecal material, Dr. Mo, get into the water supply from fertilizers?
So human fecal material is not likely to get into the water supply from fertilizers, I think.
Mm-hmm. But animals don't carry this virus?
So the noroviruses that infect animals are different from the ones that infect humans.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as we know, there hasn't been any documented evidence of animal noroviruses infecting humans.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take some calls and address some of the other questions from our listeners about noroviruses, which is the topic of today's Please Explain. I'm talking with Doctors Christine Moe and Aaron Margolin, and I hope you also want to join us by calling us at 212-433-9692 or writing in your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back with Dr. Aaron Margolin, a professor with the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Biomedical Sciences at the University of New Hampshire, and Dr. Christine Moe, the Eugene J. Gangarosa Professor of Safe Water and Sanitation, Director of the Center for Global Water at Emory University. We're talking about noroviruses on today's Please Explain, and we have a lot of questions coming in from listeners. John asks, wants me to ask you about the recent outbreaks of stomach flus on cruise ships. Would they be likely to be noroviruses?
Norovirus is, I'm afraid, a notorious cruise ship inhabitant. There have been lots of outbreaks on cruise ships, and it's partly because you have a lot of people in close contact with each other. So norovirus likes to cause outbreaks in places where you have people living close to each other, cruise ships, but also university campuses, schools, military bases, military ships. Other things that make cruise ships more susceptible, you have a lot of people touching the same surfaces, so touching handrails, touching poker chips. So that was something that Dr. Margolin mentioned, is that you can get the virus on surfaces, the virus can persist on surfaces, and so if somebody has vomited or had a fecal accident and you go into that bathroom and touch some of those surfaces, then you can be at risk.
Now, Dr. Margolin, how do scientists determine that it is a norovirus that's caused these people getting sick?
There's two ways. There's testing out there that is a rapid testing that uses antibodies and enzymes, and it's a very rapid way, but unfortunately it doesn't have a great deal of sensitivity. There's a much more sensitive way known as real-time PCR, polymerase chain reaction, that allows us to detect the virus on a very sensitive matter, and we can detect very few of them, and that's what Dr. Mo was alluding to when she was doing her studies. But once again, the proper test, depending upon what you were looking for. So if you were thinking about an outbreak that might be occurring, like, for example, on a cruise ship, then the primary objective would probably be more to screen large numbers of individuals to see if they contain the virus, rather than if you were looking more for a needle in a haystack, which is often the times what happens when you're looking for the virus in water or foods, because you have a large volume of the sample and it only takes a very few viral particles. With noroviruses, it can be as little as 10 viral particles to set up an infection. So in that kind of situation, you want to have a very sensitive test. So you have to make the decision process of whether you want sensitivity or you want to process a lot of samples very quickly.
A caller asks if using straight rubbing alcohol or is more practical than the gel kind. Others wonder about over-sanitization, whether that's one of the reasons we're having some of these problems. Do either of you want to address that?
Christine, I'll let you take the first one, and if you want, I'll take the second one.
Sure, sounds good. So we have done studies of hand sanitizers in my lab, and we've also done studies using alcohol, and these viruses just do not seem to be sensitive to alcohol.
What about Lysol, another listener asks? Does a Lysol spray kill these viruses?
The best thing to use, and what we use in our lab, what I use at home, is a bleach solution, because we know that they're very sensitive to chlorine bleach.
So we should wash down our bathrooms with bleach solutions?
If you have a norovirus outbreak sweeping through your family, then I think a dilute bleach solution would be the most effective way to clean the bathroom and the kitchen.
Dr. Margolin, you wanted to answer the second part of that question?
Well, I think if I remember correctly, the second part was
over-sanitizing.
Yeah, over-sanitizing. And my personal response is yes, we are. I don't know that that's leading to any more or any greater number of outbreaks that occur. But there is a hypothesis out there known as the hygiene hypothesis that does state that we are over-sanitizing the society that we live in and exposing ourselves to a lot of chemicals that are not necessarily good for our body in a long-term, low-level toxicity approach to things. In addition, once again, I want to go back to saying that, you know, our immune system has been with us for as long as we've been alive, and to ask our immune system to be shut itself off in a relatively short period of time creates some problems in of itself. So, yeah, I think, you know, in my day and age growing up, your parents used to say, go outside, it's a beautiful day, go out and play, and you would get dirty, and there you would be exposed to different microbes that would help stimulate your immune response. Today, I think most individuals spend a good deal of their time in front of their computers or televisions and are not necessarily going outside. And so I think there's some ramifications in the long term, whether that's actually causing more outbreaks than we have had in the past, I don't know. I think maybe this is more of a reporting situation. We now have methods for detecting and reporting these types of outbreaks, and so it may seem like there are a greater number, whereas before, you know, you didn't know exactly what was causing the outbreak.
Okay, let's take some calls. Richard from Bayside, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, doctors and Leonard. I had a number of questions. Number one, I've recently been using bathrooms that have motion-sensitive washing stations and toilets, and I was wondering what the doctors thought about that. That's one question. The second question is, do medical people, doctors, nurses, et cetera, do they always wash their hands thoroughly between patients and dry? And then I have a third question.
Wait, two questions is
okay,
the maximum.
Okay.
Well, they're supposed to wash their hands thoroughly, but would they be passing on neuroviruses if they didn't? Wouldn't they be passing on mostly bacterial matter if they're doctors?
No, actually, bacteria are probably one of the more easily killed group of organisms. When we think of the hierarchy, bacteria are much more susceptible to a lot of the things that would kill it very easily. And then there are viruses, and then there are what are called cysts or intestinal parasites, which are very resilient and resistant to inactivation.
Well, Dr. Moe, what about these automatic toilets? Are they cutting down on transmission?
Well, I think the fact that there's less touching going on is certainly a good thing. So with the sink, if you have a motion sensor that turns on the water, whatever minimizes the surfaces that you have to touch, I think that's good. I think.
But for New Yorkers who drive on, who go on the subway, we hold on to poles that somebody else just held on to. I could get rather paranoid.
That could be a risk, yeah.
And I think that's why when you go into grocery stores, you know, that they will have their hand sanitizer towel wipes there, mm-hmm. so that before you grab onto the carriage, you can go ahead. I think Dr. Gerber also showed that you know, these carriages can act as means of transferring organisms, and so now you can get a sanitizing wipe and wipe down the little hand part that you hold onto your carriage before you go grocery shopping.
Michael from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with the requirement that food workers utilize rubber gloves or vinyl gloves in the preparation of food. And I was wondering whether or not there has been any study as to the effectiveness of the use of these rubber gloves or the plastic gloves.
Christine, I'll let you take that.
So I think it depends on how the gloves are used. So if the gloves are only used to touch food and then they take off the glove when they go to the bathroom or when they're touching other surfaces, then that's an appropriate use of gloves. And that would protect the food from becoming contaminated. Because one of the biggest problems with the norovirus outbreaks in food is that it's usually because the food has gotten contaminated from the hands of the food handlers themselves in the kitchen or during the serving. So I think gloves is an effective way to cut down on that, yeah.
Let's go to Amber from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi. I had a question. I was wondering if people are more or less susceptible to a stomach virus for any reason. I asked because, for instance, I'm 36 and I only had a stomach virus once in my life, and my children have never had one, even though we have breakouts in the area. And I'm not a super tumor folk. And just wondering, we've been lucky, or are there
or does she? You have a stronger immune system, perhaps? Dr. Moe?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at that. We have, in our studies with human volunteers, we found some people who did not get infected with the virus, even though we were giving it to them in a glass of water to drink at a dose that we knew should infect them. And what we found out later was that some people do have genetic resistance to some of these viruses because they don't have the receptor on their cell. It's a carbohydrate receptor that the virus binds to. And different noroviruses are looking for different receptors. So you may be immune because of genetic reasons to a large group of noroviruses, but you may still be susceptible to some other noroviruses or other viruses, depending on whether or not you have those receptors in your body.
Sabrina has written in to ask, does chlorine in pool water protect against these viruses?
Yes. chlorine will protect. The question is as long as the chlorine concentration is maintained at a level that it is effective. And that is often the time when we look at waterborne outbreaks, especially that have occurred from these recreational water parks. It's often when they trace this back, have found out that the chlorine level, the proper chlorine level, was not maintained. Sun is a very good way of dissipating chlorine, and unless it's replaced on a regular basis, the chlorine level falls below what's called the effective dose. And since this water is washing over the private areas, I'll leave it at that, of all these individuals, if that concentration falls too low and then you put this water in your mouth, which most of us do, you're effectively propagating that fecal oral route very nicely.
Paul, you're on the air.
Yes. A question about the bathroom situation with the flushing the toilet. Then what should we do? Is it just a simple matter of closing the lid, or is there something else that we should be doing to disinfect the bathroom, after use?
Now, closing the lid would prevent that mist, that spray from spreading over to the sink, wouldn't it?
Yeah, closing the lid helps on the toilet sneeze. Unfortunately, many places, I know, like in my own institution here at the university, there are no lids, and so there's nothing to close, and that's not unusual in many places where you don't find it. Now, in the home, yes, closing the lid, but actually in the home, sharing microbes, even if you don't do it through a toilet flush, is something that you're going to do in all likelihood on a regular basis.
Now, are neuroviruses connected to any other illnesses, or are they unique unto themselves?
Christine?
People have been calling in to asking about celiac disease and all sorts of other problems.
I can say that for those individuals who are sufferers of things like irritable bowel syndrome and Crohn's disease and any of the intestinal afflictions that we see, the one thing that I always tell people who work in my own laboratory where I have many different enteric pathogens is you really don't want to around or become infected with something that has the opportunity to exacerbate the situation of another illness. So if you have irritable bowel syndrome, you don't really want to be getting something that's going to further irritate the intestinal tract that may then further trigger a greater response on something like that.
Can neuroviruses ever be lethal?
So for people who have other illnesses, for people who are quite fragile, quite ill, sometimes it's possible that a norovirus infection could contribute to illness, especially in the elderly, perhaps in nursing homes. If someone gets very dehydrated from a norovirus infection or a norovirus illness, that could be something that would contribute to death. I'm not sure I would say as a standalone cause of death, it's pretty unlikely.
And I think that's important because if you look at the CDC report for 2011, there's about 149 people that have died. And it may be misleading to think that they've died from norovirus directly. And as Dr. Moe has pointed out, it's usually not that. It's what happens is that they become dehydrated. And through this process, they have an imbalance of electrolytes. And these are the things that keep your heart beating in the normal rhythm. And when this, all takes place, that's when you end up with secondary problems due to the loss of fluids and the loss of electrolytes. And that's when you hear people that and those are usually the very young, the very old, or the immunocompromised.
And we become dehydrated because those fluids are part of the process of cleaning out the body?
You're losing fluids on a regular basis in the diarrhea or the vomiting, and if you don't replace them, it's one of the where like things like Gatorade actually first started from in sporting events. That's no longer the situation. Gatorade has changed its formulation, but Pedialyte and things of that nature are not only replacing the fluid, but they're also replacing the electrolytes that are necessary to maintain good nervous transmission, good heart rhythm, and things of that nature, so that you don't die from what are known as secondary causes.
Doctors, thank you both so much for participating in today's Please Explain. We've been looking at neuroviruses a lot more common than you would think, because I don't think too many people recognize the name. Dr. Aaron Margolin, Dr. Christine Moe, thank you both so much. It's been fascinating.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.